Welcome to Making Comics, a podcast exploring the comics process from two different perspectives. I'm Scott Loss, the creator and artist of The Second Shift and Wanderers of Milsanda for the Accidental Aliens.
And I'm Keith Foster. I write the comic Kadoja and review horror at my website, keithrfoster.com, as well as on ihorror.com.
And I'm Gary Hodges. I'm an indie comic creator. I create the indie comic series D vs. M.
Hell yeah, man. It is time. You have done it, Gary. You are the first guest on the podcast, and we're thrilled to have you, man. So
honor. Thank you so much.
Yeah, you've already gotten, I think, three or four shout-outs on the pod just casually. I did one where I mentioned your book. I pimped the book out a little bit. But then you've also just posted stuff where Keith has mentioned it or I have mentioned it. And I think it was like 3 or 4 weeks in a row. So it was kind of cool.
Yeah.
It's pretty cool. I mean, I'm a fan anyway, but, you know, it makes me an even bigger fan.
we appreciate you. We appreciate you listening to the pod.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, before we get into our weeks, maybe, Scott, why don't we start with Gary? So, Gary, we were just having a conversation and then we cut ourselves off a little bit, right? So, Scott, why don't you pick up from there?
Oh, I was just going to ask him about, so we were talking about Cox Communication and what do you have, Keith?
I have Spectrum, who sucks.
Spectrum, okay. So
legal name is Spectrum, who sucks. I believe it just changed.
Oh, okay. All right. I think it's SpectrumThatSucks.com. Mm-hmm. So, Gary, what you're mentioning you have a bunch of Cox issues.
Yes. I can't tell you all the problems I have with Cox. It's just crazy.
So do you ever find that, like, when you're working, like, I know
we're
you do
12.
This is our humor.
Yeah, this is
good. I know you have a podcast, or not a podcast, I'm sorry, you have a YouTube channel. Are you doing that throughout your house, or are you doing that in the office? And if so, like, have you ever had issues while you're recording and then had to, like, redo something because the internet went out?
I'm never doing anything. Actually, the show, let me start over with that. The videos I'm doing for my channel, I pre-record them and I edit and everything, so it's not really reliant on the internet connection. The only time it becomes a problem is if I'm guesting on someone else's show and we're doing like a live stream. And then sometimes you'll see, like, that great moment where I just freeze and you just see me holding a weird expression with, like, one eye open for, you know, 15 or 20 seconds until I sort of refresh my router or something and get back in. Or I'll just drop out and I'll have to re-enter. So there's that kind of stuff. But for when it comes to my channel, like, I'm recording everything offline. It doesn't really affect anything.
Right. So, Gary, you've listened to the podcast. You know how the podcast goes. And by being a guest, we're going to start things off by asking you, what did you do last week?
Oh, boy. Okay. Well, so as I mentioned in the intro, I have an anthology comic series. I'm 2 issues into what's probably going to be like a 6-issue arc. And I've been working on trying to get the scripts together for the next 2. I'm actually, normally I do a script and then draw it and release it, and then go and write the next script, draw it and release it. That's how I've done the first 2. This time, I kind of wanted to just knock the next 2 scripts out, like just do writing for a little while and then switch to drawing. So I've been trying to chip away at my ideas for the next 2 comics. I've been doing that for a month or 2 now, just very casually, not in a very serious way. Kind of starting to get a little bit nervous, where I was feeling like that big idea, those sort of gems of inspiration that will come that will kind of get you motivated and give you momentum into really working hard, like they hadn't come yet. I'm sure both you guys kind of know what I'm talking about, where you can do the work, you can put your butt in the chair every day, but sometimes, like, inspiration hits. And that will really take you. Like, then you'll really start getting stuff done, and you'll really start getting excited about how it's coming together. And I was kind of waiting for that to kind of jumpstart me.
I know exactly what you're talking about. I have that struggle on the art end. You know, since I'm doing just the art part of it, And, you know, like me and my writer will collab or whatever. But once I get that script, like sometimes it's just like, okay, like I really need to push myself to get to the thumbnails, or I really need to push myself to start a page, you know? So I know exactly where you're coming from.
I have similar issues. I suppose that, you know, maybe 10 years ago or something, I figured out my own personal way around that, which is if I get jammed up on one thing, I just move to another thing, because I'm the kind of person that likes to always have a few things going at the same time, right? I mean, I'm sure we all do, but for me, I just hop over to the next one. I'm also a big fan of just the absolute blunt force trauma idea of just absolutely just hammering away at it until you figure shit out. You know what I mean? And just thinking about it. Yeah. So you've been doing that. You've been banging your head against a wall waiting for it to fall.
Yeah, I've been just working, and believe me, I spent a lot of my earlier days, my younger days, always waiting for inspiration and only working if I was inspired, which I will tell anyone now is a terrible, terrible mistake. Like, you need to work every day. Like, whether you're into it or not, whether you have a great idea or not, you need to put your ass in the chair and work. But, like, I think part of my process is I really start to feel like I've got something when I'm really excited about an idea. You know, that's mm-hmm. like, I can work on it. I can get an outline going. I can get some drafts going. I can start kind of shaping something. But I really feel like, all right, now we're firing. When, like, something hits, it's like, yeah, that's the idea. That's it. That's what I'm going to do. And, like, that's what mm-hmm. kind of gets me going. So I've been kind of just dutifully working but not having that moment. And then about a week ago, and this is just there's no rhyme or reason to it, I was lying in bed trying to fall asleep, and it just all started flooding in. Like, and it's kind of great when it happens, but it was just like this creative flood of like, oh, you know what I'm gonna do? Like, all these parts I wasn't quite sure about, or I hadn't quite figured out. It was like, I'm gonna do it like that. Oh, yeah. And I'm gonna cut, I don't need this part. I'm gonna just start with this part. And, like, you know, it really just started just gushing in. It was kind of amazing. So this last week has been just taking notes like crazy, organizing my notes like crazy, rearranging stuff, cutting stuff out, adding new things with new ideas. And I kind of feel like within this next week, I think I can start writing a first draft of the next comic. So it's finally kind of, something broke loose, and I can't explain it, but it's coming together.
Yeah, no, those are great moments, and I definitely love when those happen.
You're referencing a lot of something that I've mentioned on some episodes of Making Comics so far, which is the idea of when people ask you how long it takes to write something. It's a very hard question to answer, because it's very much a tip of the iceberg. The part you see above water is the time you actually spend, like, writing the story, right? Like, okay, now today I'm going to write this scene. The stuff under the water is all of the thought formulation that goes into this, right? Where, you know, you can't just sit down and write a random thing. You need to have an idea of why the hell you're writing it. And it feels like you're kind of in that spot where you are moving from the thought formulation to, like, thought execution.
Absolutely. The way I've always shorthanded it to people, especially people who aren't creatives, is like it's like composting. You're sort of, I mean, almost literally, you're just taking all this raw material. You have a rough idea of what you want to do, and you're just sort of letting it cook, you know? And it's always there. And it sounds like a joke, but sometimes, like, even if you're just sitting playing a video game, or you're taking a shower, or you're taking a walk or something, it's in the back of your head. You know, you're thinking, how mm-hmm. am I, what's it going to be? And I really believe that something is happening beneath the surface where it's organizing itself into something. It's turning from banana peels into soil. Like, something is happening. And at some point, I think, like last week, it just hits, like, there it is. There we go. You know, the little bell goes off. Bing, you're ready. And now it's like, okay, I got it. I finally got a handle on this.
It's so interesting to hear, because I do not do any of this. So being an artist, I get, you know, beyond me and my writer doing some brainstorming, I don't know what happens after we get off the phone with him. So this is interesting to hear, and it's something I'm going to follow up with him and ask him questions on. So yeah, it's all very fascinating. Like, I would say the part of the process that I'm at, it's like, okay, the composting's already happened. The seeds have been planted or whatever, and it's, you know, bared some vegetables or fruit or whatever, and I get the fruit. Now I got to dice it up and arrange it. Like, or okay, how am I making this meal? You know, it's like we got an idea what we're cooking, but you know, like, okay, what do I start with? What ingredients need to go first, etc. So, just very interesting part for me to listen to.
Yeah,
especially YouTube, both going back and forth. You know, it's just like, let me just sit. Like, you know, after you spoke, I was like, I don't have much. Let me let the two writers talk about this, and I can just sit here with my generic White Claw and enjoy.
Well, I think what's interesting too is that Gary does both, right? I mean, Scott, you're pretty, you know, you're heavy on the art side. And you dabble in writing, and of course you consult on writing and things like that. And I am heavy, heavy on the writing side. You know, I do some artistic things as the job dictates, but it ain't my jam. And so we have Gary that does both. And so I find that fascinating. I think we kind of lucked out in the fact that our first guest is actually someone who does the entire comic, start to finish, right? So I find that fascinating.
Yeah, the whole thing. And I would say that while drawing presents all its own kind of challenges and different kinds of challenges and pulls on different parts of your brain and your creative ability, it does feel a little bit more like executing a plan. I think the writer part is a little more, to me, like mysterious and more like what Keith and I, you know, were saying. Like, there's a little bit more of this esoteric kind of waiting for something to kind of sort itself out in your subconscious aspect that I don't get with the drawing part. The drawing part is difficult in its own way, but there with writing, there's a little bit of waiting for something to happen.
Okay, so I know you said you started writing, working on both scripts. Now, are you still in... Oh, you said you're just taking notes and stuff like that. Was that for both books?
For both books. Actually, it was a little frustrating because when I was wrapping up drawing my latest one, D versus M 1997, when I was wrapping that up, I started getting a lot of ideas and a lot of ideas I was excited about for what will be my fourth book, which was kind of irritating for me because, like, I'm writing these all down, like, oh, that's a good idea. Oh, I think I want to do something like this. But that's not the next book I was going to do. And it was starting to get me anxious that it's like, I really, if I'm going to be having ideas, I should be having ideas for the, like, this isn't helpful. Like, I need to be getting ideas for the next book. But I'm not going to just, like, I don't want to risk forgetting anything. And, like, if an idea comes and it's like, oh, I think I got to do this, I got to do this. Oh, I think I need a character like this. Like, I'm going to write it down. So that's what started with, like, well, maybe I'll just sort of work on both of these in tandem a little bit. Once I get to the point of I'm going to start writing a script from page one, it will only be the next one. It won't be number four. It will be number three. I've never attempted writing two scripts at once. I would be a little anxious about that. I like to, in fact, I think one of my weaknesses as a creative is I tend to be super single-minded and have super tunnel vision. So if I am drawing, that's all I want to do. I don't really want to write. And if I'm writing a script, I don't want to screw around with drawing, and I don't want to be writing maybe something else on the side. You know, I kind of have to know what is the thing in front of me, and then I will attack that just relentlessly until it's done. But I'm a terrible multitasker.
Well, I think that's a great process, and to that note, you will get stuff done, you know? Like, there's too many creators out there that will get lost in the weeds, you know? It's just like, oh, well, I want to do this and I want to do that. You know, it's good that you thought of things for the next issue, and you can't help it. It's just like when the idea pops into your brain, it is best just write it down. You're going to forget it. I mean, I was talking to my writer, Ed. This happens to me a lot. We have like the first 30 issues of Second Shift planned, and I'm on issue 10 right now. So, but I have like scenes we've talked about, like we have this story arc coming up on issue 15, and it's a 5-issue story arc, and we have like the good majority of it plotted out. We have all of these bullet points that we want to hit, and it's just like, man, I can't wait to get to this story in 2 years. So you know, I know what you mean by like, you know, thinking of ideas and you're like, oh man, this is nowhere close to being like on the table yet. And I know that was happening with me with my first story arc. I was drawing issue 3 and I couldn't wait to draw issue 5. And at that point I was way slower than I am now. And it's just like, okay, well, that's a couple of, you know, a couple years away or a year and a half away. So, yeah, it's, I get that. I understand what you mean.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I would say that I don't think the single-mindedness here is a bug. I think it's a feature. You know, from my perspective, and I think I mentioned this before, even when I get my hands on something as rote as lettering, I find myself tweaking, right? For tweaking the dialogue, not trying to be a heroin user. I think, although I'm going to withhold any additional information to leave it to people's imagination. But, you know, like the thing is, by pushing it out to a letterer, it allows me to just, you know, box it up in a package and be done with it. And I think what you're doing is, I think that compartmentalizing that you're doing is great, because you finish the writing, and then if you just want to draw, then you're just going to stick to execution, and I think that's a benefit, right? Because you're not going to get bogged down in, oh, well, what about this writing thing, what about that writing change, nope, you've almost just entirely switched hats, and you're cranking along as the artist now. So yeah, I actually don't think it's a detriment. I think it's an advantage.
I think it makes it a lot easier to actually get things done. I mean, and sometimes it's funny, like I've talked about in some of my on my YouTube, I do videos on different steps of my process. And something I've talked about before is when I'm, for example, when I'm writing a script, I kind of think of it as, you know, now I'm writer Gary. And sometimes I'll be writing things that I know, like, this is going to be a nightmare for drawing Gary. I don't know how drawing Gary can draw this. I don't know how, if he can draw this. But, you know, fuck drawing Gary. Drawing Gary's going to have to figure it out. You know, like, yeah. This is what I think. Writer Gary thinks this is the story, and this is what the script should be, and this is what we should show. This, you know, this is what it should look like. And, you know, drawing Gary is just going to have his work cut out for him. And then, like, drawing Gary is sometimes cursing at script Gary, where it's like, I don't even know how to begin, like, to show this. I don't know what to do. And I tend to be loyal to script Gary, where it's like, I want to tweak this dialogue a little bit because it'll fit better into a dialogue bubble, or it'll fit better into a panel. But I don't do any rewriting. Like, once the script is done, like, I could show you my final drafts. And even though I was drawing for maybe 8 months or, you know, more than a year afterward, it doesn't deviate much. There might be little tweaks, mm-hmm. but it's, to me, the difference between, like, a movie script and how the actor said the line on set. Like, it's subtle stuff, yeah. You know?
Yep, I'm with you.
Yeah, I do. I don't do that. So when my writer sends me a script, I'm like, oh, fuck that. I'm not drawing that. And I'm like, you know, or I'll try to look for a workaround. And, you know, I will try to keep most of what he's writing. You know, like, I've said it before, I'm so thankful Ed does not have an ego when it comes to his writing. It's like, he's a go-with-the-flow type of guy. So if my explanation makes sense, which I usually won't do anything that doesn't make sense, he just goes with it, you know. And we'll go back and forth on the script. And, you know, by, like, the fourth go-around, it's pretty much finalized. And we're pretty much tweaking it all the way up until, you know, we send it to the printers. So it's a little bit of a different process. Hopping back to the, you know, artist Gary, writer Gary, I realize I do the exact same thing. I've done a couple of projects where I'll write short stories, but I work kind of like Marvel method. I have the idea of what's going on in the story, so I can draw it, but I have no dialogue per se. I kind of know what they're going to say or what's go- I know what's going on, but I don't know what they're going to say exactly. And so as soon as I finish the art, that's when I go back. It's like, okay, writer Scott, you got to take over because the art's all done. Now you now figure out what's going on, you know, via words. And it is, I don't know. It's, I wonder if a lot of people work that way, like more often than not.
That's fascinating. Like that, I'm trying to picture doing it that way. I mean, what's so neat, I think, about talking to other creatives is everybody's process is totally different, it seems like, you know? And it can be sometimes really bananas to hear how people go about it. It works for them, so it's like you can't question it. It's like, hey, you're getting stuff out there, so awesome. But also you realize that it's not interchangeable. And it's why I'm always a little, almost any of my videos where I'm talking about process, I have disclaimers somewhere in there saying like, look, this is what I do. You, whoever you are watching this at home, this might not work for you, you know? And if you do it and you realize like, no, this is bullshit, I can't do it this way. That's, maybe I'm helping you find your way, you know, by realizing like, I don't want to do it the way Gary does it.
That's one of my favorite lines. Yeah, you learn something from everyone, even if it's what not to do.
For sure. Yeah, and it might work for them, but that doesn't mean it'll work for you and vice versa.
Exactly. And that line is born out of sarcasm, right? But in this case, it's born out of no two processes are need to be necessarily alike, and we all work differently. I mean, listening to you guys, it's interesting because I work differently if the book is different. You know, my process on animals is different than my process on Kadoja. It's just how it evolved, you know? So not only do processes vary by person, they can also vary by project for the same person.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. And to me, the only way to judge any of it is, are you getting completed workout? Like that's the only metric that I really care about. I know I personally, I write a script. It's in screenplay format. Like, I don't know how other people write, but like, that's how I do it. And then once I'm done with the script, I do thumbnails. And once I do the thumbnails, I start drawing it just from page one. And to do it any other way, I have no idea if I could pull it off. But I also wouldn't just go out there and tell people, like, this is how you write a comic. Like, I would never presume.
So with that method, I actually started that way with my writer. Neither one of us knew exactly what we were doing. We kind of had a rough idea. And so he was giving me scripts, screenplay style, essentially, kind of like prose. And so I would do the same process. I would get the script from him. I would do minor tweaks, like, we could take this part out or whatever. And then I would start thumbnailing it. And by the end of the issue, it would be either like 21 pages or 29 pages. So, and for me, that wasn't something that we would be able to continue. Just because I needed to stay within a page count. Like, I didn't want to go all the way up to 29. It's like, okay, I'm kind of funding the project and we need to stay under this this amount. So with 28 pages and at that time how slow I was, it's like, there's no way I'm going to get this done in a reasonable manner. So we need to figure something out. So after I think about, I want to say four issues, maybe five issues, we started doing a comic book method. And it helped a lot. So basically, I would he'd do the script and he would figure out, okay, this part of the script is page one, page two, etc. He even broke them down into panels. I told him, I'm like, look, you don't even have to do panels. If you could just tell me where this page starts and where the page finishes, then at least I'll have an idea of how many panels it is and how long the script's going to be. So with all that said, do you know roughly how many pages that you're going to end up doing, like based off of your script? Like, do you get kind of a visual idea in your head a little bit as to how many, you know, like, okay, this scene here, this is about three panels or whatever, or three pages. Do you have any idea in your mind?
Basically, no. Sometimes okay. I have a very rough idea of, and I might even have a very specific vision where I'll write into the script like over the next three panels or something like that. But generally speaking, not at all. It's written very much like a screenplay, which, as both you guys will know, anyone who's tried to do a comic will know, how a script translates into a comic is there's not a clear algorithm for that. So once I do thumbs, that's when I have a sense, because I can figure out, like, I typically average about 6 panels a page. So how many thumbs did I come up with? Divide by 6. That is probably roughly what my page count's going to be. And until then, it's kind of, for both times I've done one of these books, there's a little bit of suspense, you know, when I'm doing my thumbnails and I'm plotting it out, I'm figuring out, well, this will be a page, this will be a page. And with the thumbs, I'm also figuring out my page turns, which I'm kind of crazy about, which is I want to know, like, there are some panels I want on the left side. Like, when you turn a page, I want it to be the first panel you see. I want this panel to be big. I want this one to be small. So you're working all that out. Once I've made all those decisions, that's when I can start ballparking my page count. And I'm always crossing my fingers it's lower, just for the sake of Art Gary. But at the same time, Script Gary is like, look, if it's a 400-page comic, it's a 400-page comic. I do not want to do a 400-page comic, but, like, that's how Script Gary thinks.
Yeah.
The last one I did, D versus M 1997, that was 59 pages. And when I did that math and first saw what I'd gotten myself into, you know, I had a day or two of just, like, a lot of beer drinking. Just realizing, because you know now this is your future. My rate, I don't know your guys' rate, but I have a day job. I can't work on it all the time. I can do about a, I, not about, I do, I hold myself to a finished page a week. So if I'm doing a 59-page book, well, the next 59 weeks of my life, I know what I'm doing with my free time and weekends, you know? And so that's...
How many pages was 75?
75 was, I think the story was 40 pages. There was some, like, okay, you know, appendix stuff around it, but I think that was basically a 40. They're fat books. They're kind of, it's an anthology series, so each one is kind of a standalone, you know, like, you don't have to read the other ones. I think it enhances it, but... Each one is a complete arc, a complete story, you know, so they have to be a little fatter than just, like, your typical 20-page thing. I think there might be a 20-page D versus M in my future. I kind of have dreams of doing, like, a really short, tight one that's kind of mm-hmm. the model is the first, you know, 10 minutes of up. Like, I can tell somehow a complete emotional story in just, like, very minimal space. But... I don't worry too much about the page count. As long as I feel like the story is right and I'm happy with the story, whatever the page count is, I'll live with it.
When it comes to writing music, it's always been like that. You know, some songs are meant to be a minute and a half and some songs are meant to be 10. And you'll figure that out as you go. You know, you just start kind of working on it. And you're like, oh, yeah, this song I could add this and I could add this and I can add that. And it's like, wow, this song's getting kind of long, but, you know, whatever, fuck it. And then other songs, it's just like if you do anything more than like a simple thing repeated for a minute and a half, you're boring people, you know. So yeah, man, I can definitely see how that relates to stories as well.
Imagine if Iron Butterfly had said, "This Inagata De Vita is a little long. It's going to kill us. Let's not do it." I mean, that'd be crazy. Think of what the world would look like today.
Yeah. which is by the way, there is a radio edit of the original Iron Butterfly in it. Gotta De Vita, and it's 3 minutes, and it feels like you just like watch the intro credits to the movie, and then they ushered you out of the theater. You know, it's crazy.
Say it's despicable. This is unacceptable. Yeah.
There was a couple of things you said in there. I wanted to make sure Keith got in before I went on again. So the page turn. That has been something that I've been focusing on way more these days as well. In my first trade paperback of the second shift, there's so many things because of how me and Ed were working. And like the first issue, it's I had literally taken 10 years off from drawing to be a pro wrestler. And so it was me trying to figure something out. And there's so many page missteps on the page count. It's like, oh, this is on the right side. And it's just like human nature. Even I remember as a kid telling myself, don't look ahead. Don't look ahead. You know, you're on the left side of the page and you're looking at something, but there's something inside of you that makes you need to look to the right. And so, yeah, the page turn is huge. So I'm definitely focusing on that now. Like that's a big one.
Yeah, it becomes a huge part of me figuring out my pages, because I have a mock-up of every page before I'm drawing it. Like, it basically, I do my thumbnails of each panel, and then I'll do a mock-up of each page that's very rough, extremely, extremely rough. In fact, if you go to my Instagram right now, I think I've got one that just shows, like, what basically my page looks like before I start drawing, just what I'm thinking.
I just looked at it, yeah. I just looked at it like 30 minutes ago, Gary. I was like, wow, that is rough. So, yeah.
It's stick figure level. Like, it's just, there's a thing here, there's a thing here, and this is where the dialogue will go. Done. And, like, move on. But in trying...
That's on your Instagram, you said?
Yeah, my latest Instagram post. It's a two-part. Okay. It's a finished page, and then if you swipe, you see, like, my thumb page. Part of how I'm figuring out how big panels have to be and, you know, how I'm pacing it is, like, I'll go through my initial panel count and figure out where are all the panels that I need to be the very first panel you see when you turn the page. What are all those? And those are going to be all your splashy ones, all your flashy ones, all your big kind of spoilery or reveal panels. Like, anything you don't want the reader to see before they should be seeing it, that should be when you first turn the page, that one. And so you kind of organize your whole book based on that.
That's so interesting with the way you work as well, because you're doing a screenplay style or... Yeah, screenplay style. What? How the hell? That sounded weird. Okay, damn you, Kirkland Hard Seltzers.
screenplay? Yeah, that's one word you're saying? Holy shit.
Screenplay? Is that a scream?
Kind of weird screen fetish thing? What is
You're just playing with the screen. Where's the nipples? So the way you work, though, it's so interesting because you're kind of... You kind of don't know with that method, like, when the page turn is going to be, because you're just, you know, you're writing dialogue, you're writing screen, like, screenplay style. So it's just, it's kind of, you're going in blind a bit, no?
Absolutely. I mean, that's why, so there's the script writing phase, and then when I feel like I've gone through a few drafts and I'm going to call this final, and as both you guys know, nothing, it's, work is never finished, it's only abandoned. Like, it's like, this is... as final gets. Then I set it aside, and there is a significant stretch of time before I'm drawing where I'm basically translating that to comic. Like, I'm looking at my screenplay, and it's like, how do you illustrate this? And how do you consider things like page turns? And how do you consider, like, how much dialogue can I really cram into a panel? And how are you figuring out... Like, I tend to do a thing, like, I think about panels in terms of timing and, like, sort of a temporal quality, too, where if I have a lot of little things happening quickly, that might be small panels one after another, just to kind of give that feel of, like, this is happening, like, right on top of each other.
Yeah, I do the same.
Also, the splashy stuff, like, this is going to be a full page. This is going to be a two page. Like, that's looking at the screenplay with kind of a red pen in hand. And saying, like, all right, I think this is a couple panels. I think this is a full page. I think this would be a page turn moment. I think this is probably as much dialogue as I can fit into a panel right here. You know, and I'm just making all those notes, and that's informing me when I'm figuring out my thumbnails.
Going back to the music metaphor, whereas you're like, okay, I think I'll do a 20 to 22 page story at some point. I'm the opposite, and I find that I like the fast songs. You know, I like the quick songs. I like to move to the next thing. So I have a lot of issues that are one and dones. It's like, okay, this is a one-part story. This is a one-shot. And then I'll have a couple that are two-parters. And then every once in a while, I want to do that longer song. So I'll have the first five issues of my series was a longer story. And that's when I realized, oh, I don't want to do long stories all the time, but I was on like issue two when I figured it out. And so lately I've been doing mostly like these one shots and maybe two parters, but then it's building back up to me wanting to do a longer story. So, you know, on issue 10, I'm already looking ahead to issue 15 where we'll be doing a five parter. So yeah, mine tends to be the opposite.
Yeah, I tend to be a long form person. It reminds me of something my novel teacher said, which was, you know, writers are generally good at either short stories or novels. It's very rare to find someone who is equally good at both and excellent at both. And so for me, it's like when it comes to writing, I cannot, you could not, if you gave me 20 pages to write a story, I'd barely know what to do. You give me 400, I'm in, you know, and it's just how I am, you know, like even the Kadoja stuff, it's like, not only is every arc something that's, you know, that's going to be 4 or 5 issues, but it's meant to be all the arcs fit together into a nice clean thing. And that's fun as hell. You know, I'm starting to think about what the fourth and final volume of Kadoja is going to look like. And I'm definitely making notes on like, oh, that's right. There's this thing that I still, you know, want to answer clearly. I feel like it's being answered, but I get to tie that up and I get to tie this up and I get to tie, you know, so anyway, I definitely favor like, just give me a big old amount of pages for a story and I'm in.
That is an exciting stage to be in. I was, you know, these first two I did, there's a lot of kind of teeing things up. And there's not a lot of answers. It's presenting a lot to the reader, but it's not really showing you where it's going. And it's certainly not trying to wind anything down. And with this next one, the notes I've been doing for this next one, I was realizing I was holding back on some information. I was like, well, how can I dance around this? Because I don't want to reveal it just yet. And then I was thinking, you know what? This is 3 issues into a 6-issue series. Like, I actually can start thinking about a controlled landing. You know, I'm like, it's yeah. You know, it's not immediately, but I could actually start kind of just hinting at some of this stuff. Like, we're going to be at our destination before we know it. And that is fun.
Yeah,
it's fun to realize, like, let's start paying some stuff off, or let's at least lay the groundwork to pay some stuff off. And the last thing you want, since I know you're both Star Wars geeks, the last thing...
Hey, drink up!
The last thing I want, anyway, is kind of a Rise of Skywalker thing where it's like, all right, there's all these threads. We need to tie them all off in these 2 hours, you know? And it just feels like it's just... you know, a lot of checking boxes. Like, I think it would be, I feel like, you know, now's as good a time as any to start trying to steer everything to where I'm going, you know, and to make that not as jarring when I finally wrap this up.
You blame Ryan Johnson for that shit.
Exactly. The Rise of Skywalker sucks. That's exactly what you're saying.
That's exactly what I'm saying. I don't know about you guys. That's what I'm saying.
Well, that's funny because I say that as well. So Scott's going to need to look for a guest that actually agrees with his stupid ass perspective for the next time.
When this podcast goes up, it's going to be 15 minutes. I'm going to be like, what happened? I'll listen to it. All my stuff cut out. All of it.
Yeah, sorry, Gary. You're not a guest anymore.
Much like your book, it just redacted.
What was the cool dog in The Simpsons that they removed abruptly? Like, Itchy and Scratchy.
Yeah, his little helper.
Poochie. It was Poochie.
Poochie.
Oh.
Yes.
Oh, wait, what the hell?
And then everybody hated Poochie, and then they just abruptly, it's like Poochie went back to his home planet and just removed him. That's what you guys will do to me. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It's a shame. It's a shame. We would have really liked to have Gary on.
Yeah, but he died on the way back to his home planet, and that was that.
Yeah. He died of terrible opinions.
Toxic.
All right, so
opinion.
Why don't we... Scott, did you have any more questions for Gary before we quick jump into our weeks?
No, man. Yeah, I'm good. What'd you do this week?
So for me, I think you and I are gonna share. And Gary, if you want to jump in, feel free. You and I are gonna share a common theme here, which is Kickstarters, because yours launched and congratulations, funded on the first
thank you,
day,
thank you.
which is wonderful. And for me, I had a series of actions that ended with me submitting the Kickstarter in draft form yesterday. So for me, it was, I don't know, it's funny how it works. You know, I started doing like one thing, which led to another thing in the Kickstarter prep, which led to another thing. And before you know it, I'd just written the whole damn thing. You know, I'd written the story, I'd laid out the tiers, I'd done the challenges and obstacles. And I was like, you know what? Like, it doesn't have the video yet. And it doesn't have the graphics that I want to put in it yet, because I think my previous Kickstarter for Kadoja had this, but Scott's current Kickstarter, which you should, you know, check out and throw some funds at, also has this, which is nice visualizations of what you get in each tier. So I, you know, that's, that can be a bit of a grind. I mean, for me, that's probably going to be like a good two half days probably, or maybe a little bit less in Photoshop, putting all that stuff together. So I went ahead and just submitted it with, you know, the descriptions and the tiers and things like that. And then ideally they approve it, and then I can go back, add all the visuals, add the video, and do those things last. So yeah, I mean, I did that. Oh, I decided to make the, I'm just going over because, so fun fact, Scott and I were texting. I think it started with me sending you a question about something in a Kickstarter. And then we went back and forth for like 10 texts. And then you're like, you know, we really should talk about this on the podcast.
Yeah, you're asking me so many questions.
Yeah, I got this one more question. And then he was like, yeah, blah, blah, blah. He's like, you know, we should really talk about this on the podcast. I'm like, cool. Hey, just one more question, right? So anyway, yeah, it was stuff along those lines. So I decided on a 22-day Kickstarter. I decided to launch it on, this is really the Kickstarter of twos, because I plan on launching it on February 22nd as well.
Nice.
And then we were just talking, I think, Scott, we had some back and forth there. We were talking about something you did, which I thought was fascinating. And I had a hunch you could do it, but it was neat to see it, which was the idea of an early bird incentive. An incentive that you can do right at launch and maybe offer a slight discount of the books to encourage people to pledge within that first day window, to you know, ideally have the Kickstarter fund, you know, as soon as possible. So I thought that was pretty cool. And then I had a couple questions, which maybe you can ask. Well, Scott, why don't you answer these questions and then recap your week, right? Which
yeah,
is
sure.
I asked you the question, can you add Kickstarter tiers basically post-launch, or do they all need to be created pre-launch?
Yeah, and that's something you could definitely do while the Kickstarter is going on. You definitely don't need to have everything ready and available on that first day. It helps. It definitely helps, because you will get those eager beavers who are there for the first day. And, you know, some of them can be high rollers and some of them not so much. Like, there's a couple of people that always back my projects. And sure enough, one of them backed it the first day, and he got a high tier. And, you know, it's like, well, I had other, you know, options that I hadn't put up yet. Like, for instance, there was a $500 tier that I ended up putting up the second day. And that was just due to me not knowing if I had a spot for it. So the tier itself, it was a guest role in a future issue. I knew that the next issue of Second Shift, there is no guest spots. Like, because I have the script, I'm working the thumbnails, there is no spot to put anyone in. And so I'm like, man, I can't put this tier up. And, you know, I ended up launching, and then afterwards, I was like, you know what, I can just write in the description that their guest appearance is going to be, you know, Second Shift issue 12, or Wanderers of Melisandre 3, whichever they prefer, you know. You can definitely do those, you know, post-launch.
Yeah. All right, cool. Yeah. So that, and again, that's helpful to know, because, you know, that ideally, if you're doing a Kickstarter and it funds early, you want to have that ability to keep the campaign cranking and have more interesting things that you're adding midstream, right? And give people reasons to be excited about the Kickstarter in the time between when it begins and when it ends, right? So, yeah, and then the other thing we were going back and forth on, I guess, and you feel free to talk about whatever you want on this, Scott, but I wrote down incentive covers / artist covers and how an image helps backers want to back the tier. So both of us are planning to have like a higher incentive cover. You know, like in your case, you have the base, you know, the regular cover that comes with issue 11. And then you have an artist, a special artist doing an incentive cover. And we were going back and forth a little bit on that.
Yeah, that one's a big one. So for Wanderers of Melisandre 2, the last Kickstarter I did, I had three different covers, and I had all three covers available for the launch of the Kickstarter. So people can see the Kickstarter exclusive covers. This time around, unfortunately, I have an amazing artist doing the Kickstarter cover, and Eddie Nunez, he's so fantastic. He used to work for Wildstorm when Wildstorm was a thing, and he now works for DC, and he also does freelance work. So, or he might primarily be freelance right now. I'm not quite sure, but I know he still does work for multiple comic companies. But anyway, he just finished up his Kickstarter, so he's swamped right now, fulfilling those rewards, drawing those tiers. He had, like, I think three different art tiers that he was working on. So at the moment, he didn't have time to finish it. And he won't, unfortunately, finish it by the time the Kickstarter finishes, my Kickstarter finishes. So it does affect my bottom line a little bit, because people, they might not know Eddie's work. They might not know him just based off of his name. I'm waiting to hear back to see if it's cool if I post some of his pieces onto the Kickstarter, which I don't think he would have a problem with, but I definitely want to make sure I have approval before doing that, just so they can get an idea of what his art looks like. He has this beautiful, chunky lined, like, Marvel versus Capcom style, and it's just so perfect for this issue, since it's basically a 26-page fight scene. So yeah. it totally fits, you know, the aesthetic of the issue. But yeah, that having those covers ready for your Kickstarter is a big deal. So if I can get some kind of visual on my page showing what his work looks like, you know, for the people that don't know who he is and what, you know, what he does, that would help a lot. So
yeah, I will say, I tabled next to Eddie. I'm going to say I tabled next to him at one of the Salt Lake conventions. It was the spring one way back in the day. And I know Eddie's work, so that's actually the tier I backed, because I don't need to see Eddie Nunez's work because I've seen it before. Yeah. So for those who don't know, check out Eddie Nunez. Great stuff, and a tier worthy of backing.
And
so,
thanks, Keith and Gary, for both backing the Kickstarter. I appreciate it, man.
Yeah, rock and roll. Glad to.
I was just about to say, I was pretty sure that's the level I picked.
Oh, rock and roll, rock and roll. See, great minds, man. So, Scott, how about what else? I mean, did you want to talk anything about what it's like to, you know, to kind of be in, as we record this, you're 3 days into launch, you got a ways to go, but you got any initial thoughts you wanted to share on that?
It reminds me of how stressful Kickstarters are. I'm really trying to not think about it, you know, and one of the reasons why I do such little goals, like I did $300, you know, for the goal, because I knew I would reach it, and I would reach it relatively easily, because I do not like the stress of the larger goal amount and seeing if I'll make it. So I figure, okay, let me just cover, you know, the printing. Roughly, like, it's like, okay, this will bang out most of the printing and the shipping, and you know, for like 100 issues or so, or whatever special covers I have, it's like, okay, I think this will take care of it. And then, of course, I'll go over, so, you know, for any other incentives that I do, it'll be covered. And basically, I'm fronting the cost of the coloring, the lettering. If I had someone do it this time around, I did the lettering myself. And any other kind of costs that had gone into doing the issue beforehand, like, oh, Eddie's, you know, Eddie's cover, for instance. I was really hoping to have a second cover, but it kind of came out of nowhere. Like February flew to the forefront, like, out of nowhere. Like, you know, it's like, okay, well, I finished in October, obviously. And, you know, November, I was getting my colorist to color everything, and he had a couple of weeks where he couldn't do it. And then, so he was finished by mid-December. And at that point, it's like, well, it's mid-December. People are buying Christmas presents. I don't think it's a great idea to launch a Kickstarter now. And, you know, then finding out I could get a cover from Eddie. And unfortunately, I was thinking it wouldn't be available until like mid-January. And when I got a hold of him, he goes, oh, no, I won't be able to finish, you know, for a while. And so it was like, okay, let me just push it back to February. And, you know, there was a slight glimmer of hope that he might be able to fit it in. But he's just got so much going on. He's actually moving as well while trying to fulfill all of these rewards and mail them out and everything. So it's tough. Yeah, anyway, so that's definitely something you got to deal with when you're doing Kickstarters. It's like something that's constantly on your mind. I'm thinking like, okay, all right, has anyone backed it? You know, it's like I launch it and then I end up passing back out and I wake up, okay, did anyone back it? And it's like, okay, a couple of people backed it. That's nice. And, you know, it's just checking your phone every, you know, 15 to 20 minutes to see if something came in, and it's driving me insane. So it's just like, okay, try not to think about it. Just have your White Claws and, you know, not think about anything.
Again, with the White Claw, are they a sponsor? Am I not aware of what?
I'm pushing it, Gary. I'm trying to get that sponsor.
You're trying to win that sponsor.
Yeah, our dream sponsor. Yeah, Scott's dream sponsor, right? Now, if the fine people at Kentucky Bourbon Barrel Ale are listening, I am open to sponsorships as well.
Since we lost the Spectrum and the Cox sponsorships, I guess we got to...
Bummers.
Those are out the window, just like Keith's signal.
Hey, do you want to talk about how we met?
No. Next question.
No, bad idea.
I didn't know who was supposed to talk.
what kind of stupid? No, it's all good. So yeah, go ahead. Let's give a quick thing. Gary, why don't you go, and then we'll chime in.
Okay. So we met at the Phoenix Fan Fusion, which is the Phoenix, Arizona's Comic-Con, basically, in 2019. Is that what that was?
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We were supposed to meet again in 2020, but 2020 got canceled.
Yeah, 2020. There was something about, I don't know, something about a plague or something. But
the dinosaurs, I think.
Something. Yeah. But we were... We were neighbors, and I was relieved. I'm not just saying this because I'm on your podcast. I was relieved because, as you guys probably would have the same experience, it's a little bit like dorm mates. Sometimes you do well. Sometimes it's a nightmare. And so every con I go to, it's like, ugh, who's going to be next to me? And you guys were awesome. It was a delight to be next to you guys. I was so relieved. But then also you were cool in addition to just being a relief. No, it was great. I was happy to be next to you guys. I had some horror stories about past table mates.
Oh yeah. No, the feeling is mutual, you know, like Scott and I think have talked about this maybe off microphone before, but you know, the vast majority of table mates are actually, they're at least going to be cordial. You know, you're going to have a general like, hey, man, if you go to the bathroom, I'll watch your table for you. You know, that kind of thing.
You hope.
And that's always nice. In my experience, there have been a small percentage of people that are kind of like bad table mates, maybe a small percentage where they're just sort of non-existent. Like, you know, you never have any sort of conversation. But there's a very rare percentage where they turn out to be kick-ass people and you end up just, you know, chopping it up long after. You know, Scott and I are two of those people because we were tabling next to each other. And then, you know, you're another one of those people. And another person who I consider a good friend of mine, Albert Nguyen, is a person that I just got thrown, you know, in at a convention. So, yeah, man, it worked out well. And sometimes you get lucky.
Yeah, it's such a trip when you get like seated next to someone that wants nothing to do with you, like from the get go. And I've had a few of those. It's like, I'll have those interactions and I'm like, oh yeah, some artists are introverts and they don't want to have any conversations with you. And so those ones are always rough. I've had one where the guy was like outrageous. Like for one, he smelled awful. And, and he was like the complete opposite of an introvert. He was an extrovert, but he was like punk rock, fuck society, type of, you know, extrovert.
Yeah.
And, he would just stand on his table and hold court. And I'm like, this shit is brutal. And, I had another one where I was next to a guy and he had, built a contraption to hold all of his prints. And it was a shared table situation. It was at Long Beach Comic Con. You could buy a whole spot, which is a whole table, or a half of a spot for like half the price, and you just share with a stranger, essentially. And I was like, you know what? The price is so high. I think I can make it work. I can build up. And I get there, and this guy has this, you know, pipe monstrosity built to the table and surrounding himself. And it's like encroaching in on my space. And I'm a bit of an extrovert. So it's just so frustrating. He has three prints hanging from it. And I go, hey, man, do you need this thing? And he refused to look at me or talk to me or anything. And I'm like, you got like three prints hanging from it. Like, you couldn't just put them on your table? Because he had nothing on his table either. He was drawing. And he just would not look at me. And I ended up getting moved. So that was probably my worst experience. So to say all of that, terrible. That was not you, Gary.
I thought it was fine. That's horrible. The worst one I had, and she was actually very pleasant, but I had a woman next to me in 2018 who she had written a giant fat graphic novel, and the entire time she sat there holding a copy in her hands, and anyone who walked by, she would say, "Want to look at my book? Want to look at my book?" Like, I heard this 8,000 times a day. "Want to look at my book?" And that would have been sort of irritating, but the problem was I thought a lot of people, like the foot traffic, they were seeing this. They were being asked if they wanted to see her book. They didn't want to see her book, and they would just kind of kick it into overdrive and, like, speed away and zip right past me as a result. And I felt like she was kind of driving people off. Like, and there's no good way to say, like, stop trying to market your book. Like, there was, like, just, you know, do a little soft selling. But, I there's nothing you can say. And I kind of felt like she torpedoed me a little bit.
Yes, I've been next to people like that too. And they can even be like, they see a person coming, like walking toward them at the 20-foot mark. And it becomes kind of like a, you know, not, "Hey, do you want to look at my book?" But it's like more involved than that and more engaged. And like, I'm the table in that 20 feet. And then they just start to, you know, pick it up into fourth gear. And before you know it, they're gone. I'm like, oh my God. You know? So yeah, man, that one's a rough one, and it does feel like your sales might get and your interest might get dampened down a little bit, because people want to browse. I want to browse.
They want to browse. Like, I don't. And they're walking by people like that, like it's a homeless person asking for money, you know? And it just creates a weird vibe where it's you're just sucking all the enthusiasm. Yeah, people want to just stroll the length of these aisles and just kind of just look at stuff. But if you're being asked, like, "Hey, look at this thing. You should buy my thing." Like, it kind of, a lot of people are going to mosey on.
Yep. Exactly.
Yeah. And you're right. You were getting torpedoed. It's happened to me as well. It's happened at a couple of conventions. For the most part, I will say that it usually doesn't happen, but it's definitely happened once or twice. And it's like a wave, you know, it's like a wave comes and it pushes, the leaf or whatever, the ball away from your area, you know, just keeps going down. And you get completely passed up. It sucks.
Yep. I hear you, man. I hear you.
All right. That wasn't you, Gary. You were awesome.
Thank you. You guys were great. I had a lot of fun with you guys. So.
We were looking forward to seeing you the next year too. We're like, oh, cool. Hopefully, you know, Gary locks down his table. We've locked down our table, and we'll get to hang out with him next year. So it's super cool. Even though 2020 sucked, at least we were able to keep in touch via social media, and then now a podcast
for sure. And maybe 2022. Who knows?
All right, so I had one follow-up question. You know, I did have a couple of questions for Gary, but in the first part, you answered so many of them. But I had one question I was super curious about for D versus M 1997. And this is tough because I think there's probably a way around this that doesn't spoil the ending. But what I found particularly fascinating was where you ended the book, right? Because, you know, without giving anything away, you could have ended the book at an earlier point in time, and it would have made sense. It would have kind of felt, it would have been in line more with some cinematic endings, right? Where something important happens and then you just end it. And you probably could have ended it later in terms of being more resolution, but you chose to end it in a specific spot where we're unsure of the resolution. And I wanted to ask you, what went into that choice?
Oh, wow. Well, yes, you're right. 97 has an ambiguous ending, which I've always kind of had a soft spot for. I have to say, one of my favorite movies is Pan's Labyrinth. One of the things I like about it, there's a lot I love about that movie. And I'll try not to spoil that either in case people listening haven't seen it. But it ends in a way where it's open to interpretation what exactly happened to the protagonist. You could, there's a very cynical way to interpret the ending and a very optimistic way to interpret that ending. I've just always been interested in that, and I think it's fun for readers, if I do my job right, to wonder about it and argue about it and come up with what they think probably happened. And that has happened a little bit with Dee versus M1997. I've seen some of the fans, some of the readers kind of suggesting, they're coming to me saying, like, I think this probably happened. Am I right? Am I wrong? And I don't, I'm not going to help them out. Like, I like mm-hmm. them to wonder about it. You know, there's this thing, it's a psychoanalytical tool. It's called a thematic appreciation test. It's something I think about a lot with when it comes to being a creator. But basically the idea is it's these plates, they're illustrations that are very ambiguous. Like there's scenes of like, you know, a woman reading a letter and looking like she's sad. You know, just it's mm-hmm. it, you don't have a lot of information with this plate. And apparently they were used in like psychoanalysis. You'd present them to a patient and say, tell me a story about what you think is happening in this plate. And by design, there's not a lot there to work with. So anything you're coming up with is what you're coming up with. Like you, it's mm-hmm. ambiguous enough where you're bringing stuff to the table. And there's something meaningful in what you're coming up with. I think what's attractive to me about ambiguous endings is that. It's sort of like a mini thematic appreciation test. You now have to decide what you think happened, and I think it's that's where there's something interesting. I think it says something about you and something about what you're taking away from the story.
Yeah, like yeah, man. That's super interesting. Super interesting.
I actually have a question that I was going to ask earlier, but we're rolling. So okay, with that said, you said you could basically read the first two. You don't need to read them in a particular order. Do you think what happens in the third volume affects the story in the fourth to the point where you at least need to read those two in order?
No. I think I'm going to, okay. With the exception of the finale, I'm trying to do it in a way where you could read them in any order. I think it benefits from the order that I'm releasing them. I think that's sort of the ideal. Think of it sort of like an album. I think like if you're a musician and you're making an album, maybe you intend, like I intend you to listen to this beginning to end in order. Don't hit shuffle. Don't screw up my what I've tried to do here. My release order is sort of like the album order, but you can switch them around if you want. Without spoiling too much about three, I'm always trying to decide what's the story that makes sense after the story I just did. 75, my first one, it's the earliest story in the chronology. So like this, I thought, well, I got to start with the first part of the chronology. I'm going to end with the last part. So we're starting with 75. 75 introduces Men in Black and aliens and some innocent bystanders. I thought after telling that story, it would make sense in 1997 to now tell a story that's focused on innocent bystanders. I thought it would be a nice kind of opposite vantage point where if the first story is about Men in Black who kind of know what's going on, it'll be interesting to tell like my next story about just some rando who has no idea what's going on. That might be fun. This is a minor spoiler, but in the in 97, we introduce, you start seeing some dinosaurs running around. mm-hmm. I thought people who have read that, the natural question they're going to have is, what is the deal with the dinosaurs? So the third one I'm going to do, which is Dee versus M 1979, gets into that a little bit. You still could read it okay. in any order, but again, there's sort of a logic in like which order I'm telling these stories.
Makes sense. I like that a lot. Yeah, that was actually one of my questions. When you're talking about it earlier, you're like, yeah, you know, I'm not sure what I want to, you know, let out of the bag quite yet. And it's like, well, I got questions. And one of them is, what's up with those dinosaurs? Where do they come from?
Exactly. It's called Dinosaurs versus Mars Bots.
It's called Dinosaurs versus Mars Bots. And I felt like it was a bold thing in the first comic to not have any dinosaurs in there, you know, mm-hmm. but they weren't around yet. So now in the second one, we've skipped ahead in the timeline and there's dinosaurs running around. I just felt like anyone who's reading this, they're going to be like, well, how did that happen? You know, and it's been fun to see with readers too. Like, is there a weird time travel thing? Is there some relationship between them and the aliens? Did the government make them? So it's like, okay, well, I have to tell this story now.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Those are all of the questions that I had, and those are all of the scenarios that I ran through my mind. So you are correct.
Makes sense. All right, so why don't we go ahead and wrap this episode up, yeah?
All right, Keith, where could they find you online?
So you can find me on Instagram, in terms of social media, at Keith_Decibel. That's me. And you can also find Kadoja at the Instagram handle, at Kadoja Kaiju. That's all one word.
How about you, Gary?
You can find me on Instagram. It's Dinosaurs versus Marsbots, Dinosaurs vs. Marsbots. And from there, there's all my links to my YouTube channel, my Etsy shop, wherever else you can find me.
And you could find me on Twitter and Instagram at Scott Lost, ScottLost, or Facebook.com/ScottLost.
Yep. And then in terms of websites, I have the website KeithRFoster.com that has blog stuff, and it also has a specific page for Kadoja.
And you can find my comics, The Second Shift, The Tale of Minimum Wage Workers During the Day, Superheroes at Night, and Wanderers of Melisandre, Humans versus Anthropomorphic Dinosaurs, at accidentalaliens.com. Or right now, you can go to kickstarter.com and search Second Shift Drawtober to comic book. Or just type in Second Shift, 2nd, not S-E-C-O-N-D. Type in Second Shift and that'll pop up. You have until March 1st to back the project. I think it ends at noon. So if you could back the project before then, that would be super awesome. The more I raise, the less I have to raise for the second trade paperback of The Second Shift. So I know I passed that initial goal of 300, but that was just kind of the starter goal. And so the more it raises, the better off future issues of The Second Shift is going to be.
Well, Gary, thank you for being with us and sitting with us, man. That was dope. Yeah, man. It was great having you.
We're going to have you back on when you're in the drawing phase of your book.
Yes. Yes. Let's do it.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's a deal.
We'll talk to artist Gary then.
Oh, he'll just be swearing. Just like, you wouldn't believe this script.
Gary, what you been up to, man, before we get into the formal stuff?
Before we get into the formal stuff, not a lot. You know, just trying to dodge COVID, just like everybody else, I guess. I do have a day job. I'm lucky enough to have a day job, an illustration job. So,
yeah, I was going to say, you're like a graphic designer or something, right? I was listening to your YouTube, and you were talking about how a lot of the stuff that you do for work, you can actually apply to your comic.
Yeah, I'm a what's called a litigation graphics specialist. It's
wait, should we be talking about this in the episode?
I don't know.
Yeah, why don't we? Let me ask.
Okay, so you're dodging COVID, so that's good.
Yeah, you're dodging COVID.
I was going to say that's a little harder to.
We'll do the rest live. And one other thing, Gary, do you have a little blurb to talk about yourself when we do the intros at the beginning? Because we'll just put you third.
Yeah, just like the generic kind of intro.
Hell yeah. Sure. Hell yeah. All right, rock and roll. And then, Scott, what you drinking, man?
My generic White Claws. my Kirkland brand.
Let's see, you're doing two an episode, so we've still got those for another, like, 8 episodes probably, right?
I don't know, maybe. The weekends are rough.
I think so. Actually, this is my last one, and this is the third box I've bought since we talked, right?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, man. It's a special fucking occasion. So, Gary, just so you know, I actually had been wanting this beer, and I held it for tonight because I knew it was going to be a special day. I got myself Kentucky Bourbon Barrel Ale, which is my favorite beer.
Very nice. Yeah, that sounds good.
And actually, Gary, do you drink beer? Yeah, so out near you, there's a beer called Kilt Lifter, which I'm a huge fan of.
Yeah,
I'm a huge
fan of Kilt Lifter. Kilt Lifter. Oh yeah, that's kind of my go-to.
Okay, nice, nice. Oh. So yeah, that's actually my go-to when I don't feel like paying extra for Kentucky Bourbon Barrel Ale, because it's a lot of the same stuff. It's if Kilt Lifter doesn't do it, it's definitely the feel of like an ale type beer aged in bourbon barrels. And yeah, man, it's fucking amazing. So anyway, I just took my first sip and we're ready to go. So yeah, Scott, why don't we do all the rest of this shit live? Yeah, it is. It's going to be an odd. So that's you.
Oh, okay. And I had something while we're on beers, I had something over the weekend. It's Harland Brewing. It's a San Diego company. And they're kind of like, my buddy was explaining to me, they kind of do the Supreme model where everything's like limited edition or whatever. So you can't just like go to the store and pick up shit willy nilly, which is super unfortunate. So they do this one beer. It's called a Ube Milkshake IPA.
Whoa.
And holy shit, it is fucking delicious. I know your wife would appreciate it, you know, being Filipino.
I was
going to
say, are there
all
Filipinos in that brewery or something?
There has to be. There has to be. There's no way. Okay. So you don't go around just making ube milkshake IPAs, like if you're not or you're married to a Filipino or something. Like it's got to be, you know, definitely. You got to be exposed to it somehow. So, but I had that over the weekend, and man, it was like a game changer. I told my buddy, I'm like, where is this? I'm going to go buy as much of this as I can. He goes, good luck. I guess him and one of our other friends, they're in some kind of like beer club. Yeah. And if you're in that beer club, you have access to this. And so you're basically entered into a lottery. Oh. And our other friend, she won it and she brought him the beers. And nice. So he let me grab one. And I'm just like, man, this is a game changer.
Nice.
So anyway, nice. Gary, are you drinking anything?
Because I'm exciting, I'm drinking some peppermint tea right now. But like, it's only because I'm at the office. I thought it would be quieter. I'd get a more stable. I also have Wi-Fi problems at home. I didn't want to cut out on you guys. So I was like, I'll just go into the office. I know the connection will be good. It'll be quiet. But so no drinking for me right now.
Gotcha.
Oh, okay.
Gotcha.
Right on.
Yeah. I theoretically have Wi-Fi at home, but it's by a company called Spectrum who royally sucks. Yes, I'm leaving that in. Yeah, I'm leaving that in.
Do you guys have Cox Communications in California?
That is what I have.
Okay. I mean, is it as bad as that? I can't imagine it's as bad as... The only thing I think Cox has going for it is you get a little bit of a giggle anytime you say, like, I'm having problems with Cox.
You get a pretty big giggle over here. I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah, they give you a promo code for Blue Chew. You know, I don't seem to have that much problems. Maybe once a year there might be an issue, but honestly, maybe not even that much. But I know other people that do have issues with it, so I've been lucky enough to not have that many problems with them.
We have problems twice a week. Yeah.
Yeah, it's I would say about once or twice a week. It just will inexplicably drop out for a little while and come back. Not a long time, just enough to screw up whatever you're doing. So.
Oh, that sucks.